Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is recorded at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 8th of February. Climate scientists express alarm as, for the first time, global warming tops 1.5 degrees for a full year.
If we don't do something about it, it's only going to increase. It's going to displace more people. It's going to push more people into food security crisis. There's so much more impact than what meets the eyes.
The only remaining anti-war candidate in the presidential election in Russia is blocked from standing against Vladimir Putin. And a new round of negotiations is taking place in the Middle East. Also on the podcast...
There have been previous studies that similarly showed people taking this type of drug had a reduced risk of dementia. And already some work has been done in animals and in humans showing how this drug might be helping protect the brain.
Signs that Viagra could reduce the likelihood of getting Alzheimer's. The Earth has just experienced the hottest January on record. In fact, every month since June has been the hottest on record. And we now know the world has been an average of 1.5 degrees hotter than pre-industrial levels for a whole year. That 1.5-degree figure, confirmed by the EU climate service Copernicus, is significant because it featured heavily in the landmark 2015 Paris climate talks. All is not lost, but it suggests we are on course to miss one of the key goals to limit global warming. Ritu Barudvaj is a UK climate researcher.
These are irreversible changes, and that is why we need to limit it to this level now, because this amount of global warming is already locked in. If we don't do something about it, it's only going to increase. It's going to displace more people. It's going to push more people into food security crisis, water scarcity. There's so much more impact than what meets the eyes.
I asked our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, just how serious a moment this is.
Well, Oliver, it's very serious. I mean, it emphasises the steady increase we've seen in global temperatures since the kind of pre-industrial period. And when you draw a graph, you do see this steady increase to this new peak. And as you've said, 1.5, it's a symbolic boundary, but it's a really important boundary. There was a 2018 UN study which showed that the impacts of climate change would be really significantly more severe at 2 degrees than 1.5. We're already seeing really quite dramatic climate impacts around the world. Increasing intensity is obviously something we should all be very concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of increase are we heading for if we are already breaching 1.5 degrees?
Well, let's just be clear on the breach. The Paris commitment is a long-term commitment, so we need a decade or so above 1.5 for that formally to have been breached. But the climate scientists are saying, look, you know, we're nudging up against the boundary already. This year, 2024, is likely to be even hotter than last year, so another global record temperature. Almost certainly, the climate scientists say, it will be above 1.5. So it shows just how urgent action is. And when we talk about action, obviously, we're talking about cutting carbon dioxide emissions. They are, well, let's be clear, they are levelling off, largely a result of increasing efficiency of the kind of ways we use energy rather than an actual move away from fossil fuels. But we're still at really the highest levels of carbon dioxide emissions we have ever been. So there's a huge kind of mountain to descend if we're going to cut emissions to zero, which is the point at which, or net zero, which is the point at which, of course, we would begin to really moderate the increase in temperature, or stop the increase in temperature, I should say. So there's a kind of huge journey ahead for the world.
Yeah, and any chance of us reaching that journey, getting what we need done?
Well, look, yeah, I mean, there are kind of, you know, COP28, you heard kind of, you know, you heard powerful rhetoric, didn't you, from world leaders about, you know, the need to tackle this. But it is tricky. I mean, I kind of did the calculations in the run-up to COP28. Just 2% of all global energy now comes from renewables. Only 2%, and we talk about a renewables revolution. And that shows the kind of energy mountain that we need to tackle if we are going to reduce emissions. So it's a huge challenge ahead.
Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt. When he spoke to the BBC last week after securing the 100,000 signatures he needed to stand in Russia's presidential election, Boris Nadezhdin knew there was a good chance he would yet be disqualified. As an anti-war candidate, he would never be allowed to win. The authorities do seem to have been rattled by his popularity, with propaganda outlets turning on him. Now, as expected, Russia's election commission has said he cannot run against Vladimir Putin. Boris Nadezhdin said he will appeal to Russia's Supreme Court.
There are tens of millions of people here who are going to vote for me. According to all polls, I'm in second place after Putin. And you're telling me about 11 dead or incorrect passports. I understand perfectly well that this is a problem in the law itself. We will, of course, challenge this law.
Well, I asked Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor of BBC Monitoring, why Boris Nadezhdin ever thought he'd be allowed to run in the first place.
Well, it's the right question to ask, Oliver, because given the tight control that the Kremlin has over Russia's electoral system, it would be naive to believe that anything is possible in it without the Kremlin's approval. So the answer to that, I think, is because he was allowed to try. But it would be equally naive to believe that he would be allowed to win, even if he had been allowed to run. Because all of this fits the what's known as the idea of managed democracy, where different parties exist, different cabinets exist, but they have no chance of threatening Vladimir Putin's rule. And the people who did, people like Alexei Navalny, they're in jail. Some of them are in exile, like Alexei Navalny's, most of his supporters, or dead, such as the murdered opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. So this was possibly a way of creating an illusion of a multi-party democracy without actually threatening Vladimir Putin's rule.
Now, Boris Nadezhdin was pretty low profile. I have to confess, I hadn't heard of him until he got those 100,000 signatures. Do you think the authorities were taken by surprise by his popularity?
Possibly. And the fact that so many Russians queued up for hours to leave their signatures in support of his candidacy shows that there's a fair amount of support for him. Whether or not the Kremlin was surprised, I think it doesn't really matter that much. At the end of the day, what matters is that the Kremlin has really effective tools which it can use to stop people it doesn't really like winning from winning.
But the fact that so many people were prepared to queue to put their signature down, does that suggest that there is a considerable rump of anti-Putin feeling in Russia?
There is, because we're almost into the third year of what the Kremlin insists on calling the special military operation. Tens of thousands of Russians, as far as we know, died in this war waged against Ukraine. Of course they're not happy. Of course they're annoyed. Of course they want it to stop. And allowing them to queue, allowing this candidate to try, it was possibly a very safe way of allowing them to vent their anger without endangering the system.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Well, staying with the war in Ukraine, shame on you is the message from the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk to Republicans in the United States over their failure to back a bill including a massive aid package for Ukraine. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford in Kiev has the details.
Donald Tusk told Republican senators in the US they should be ashamed of themselves. The Polish Prime Minister said that Ronald Reagan, the former Republican US president, would be turning in his grave. They are strong words that Ukraine will welcome. But what it really needs is the billions of dollars worth of aid that America promised and that's now blocked by domestic political fighting in the US. This is a precarious moment. Here in Kyiv, officials are still hoping a new US deal might succeed, but they are braced for the worst. There's a lot of frustration and a lot of talk of broken promises.
Sarah Rainsford in Kyiv. For weeks, we've been hearing about negotiations over a possible ceasefire in Gaza in return for the release of Israeli hostages. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has insisted a deal can still be done, despite the Israeli Prime Minister rejecting the latest proposals from Hamas. An estimated 100 Israeli hostages are still being held in Gaza after the attacks of the 7th of October. Our correspondent Nick Beek in Jerusalem has details of the latest discussions.
We know, according to a senior Palestinian official who's just been talking to the BBC, that a new round of talks are underway in Cairo. And of course, Egypt, as well as Qatar, the Gulf state, are really important players in what's happening here. They're basically intermediaries in these indirect talks between Hamas and Israel. And this senior Palestinian official has just told us that he believes that the negotiations will be very complex and difficult, and that there will have to be lots of rounds of talking. Certainly, Antony Blinken, the United States top diplomat, who is still here in Israel at the moment, he believes there is an opportunity for the differences between Hamas and Israel to be reached, to be sort of bridged, and that there is room for negotiation. The thing is, though, if you watched last night the press conference from Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, he was saying that really the hopes of a ceasefire are very low because he's rejected the proposals put forward by Hamas, and he says, in fact, the military operation in Gaza will be intensified in the days and weeks to come. So that really has dashed any hopes that were lingering last week that we might be moving towards a more imminent ceasefire.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. Well, the Hamas massacre and Israel's devastating military response in Gaza has led to a surge in violence elsewhere in the region, including cross-border exchanges between Israel and the Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah in Lebanon. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been to northern Israel and sent this report.
We've stopped at the checkpoint on the edge of Matula, talking to some of the soldiers here, some of whom are reservists. Tell me, how far away is Lebanon from where we're standing?
To the west, this is a quarter of a mile. To the north, this can be a half of a mile, and then half mile to the east. So we're more or less 300 degrees surrounded by the Hezbollah.
I mean, today is really wet. There's a lot of fog, so they can't see you, right?
This is good. So fog is very good for your visit, and you can now walk all over. But if the fog is gone, so walk away, because they will probably not going to miss you.
Do they target you then?
Yeah.
So they can see into this town?
Oh, yeah, every house, they know the people, they know the faithies. We know what you do, we are after you. They send you to your mobile phone, it's amazing.
They send messages?
Yeah, we know where you're living, we know where your kids are, we're going to come after
what,
you.
In Hebrew? Or do they send in Hebrew or English, maybe?
Hebrew, you know, Google Translate,
you can do it. Could it get worse here? Could you end up having a war? I mean, a big war, not the war you're having already. It's already a war.
Yeah, it's definitely can turn into a big war. And a big war with Hezbollah, it's not like Hamas, the real army.
By a big war, he means the war for which Israel and Hezbollah have prepared since their last one in 2006. If it happened again, Israel could do even worse damage, Gaza-style, than it did then, when it killed something like 1,300 Lebanese citizens. In 2006, Hezbollah fired around 4,000 missiles, mostly unguided, into Israel, and more than 150 Israelis were killed. Since then, thanks to Iran, Hezbollah has accumulated an arsenal estimated at well over 100,000 missiles, many of which can be targeted. On both sides of the border, tens of thousands of civilians have been evacuated from their homes. Kiryat Shemona, a few miles south of Matula, is also almost empty. Orly Ben-Simon is head of the local ambulance service. She was here in 2006, and Orly remembers how bad it was then and knows how much worse it could get than it is now.
Our city has been under rocket and artillery attack since October the 7th. Thankfully, the city is empty. But 3 weeks ago, I was called to a nearby village after an anti-tank missile attack and had to declare the death of a mother and her son.
We've come to the Golan Heights, the area captured from Syria by Israel in the 1967 Middle East War, subsequently annexed, a move not recognised by most of the world. Damascus is only about 50 kilometres from where I'm standing. This building used to be a Syrian bunker. Now it's a pretty good cafe, and I'm with Haim Rocha, who is the head of the local council.
I believe holding on and staying put is the only way, because if there is no people, that allows Hezbollah to attack without retaliation.
The Americans see this moment potentially as an opportunity. They believe that the shock of the war in Gaza might become a springboard to enable them to remake the Middle East diplomatically. First thing, though, let's not get ahead of ourselves. There needs to be a ceasefire in Gaza. Otherwise, the future only has uncertainty and danger for all sides.
Jeremy Bowen in northern Israel. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
But this would suggest that there was a significant period of overlap between the last Neanderthals and the first Homo sapiens in Europe.
New research hints that we Homo sapiens may be a lot older than we thought. And Sherpas say the world's tallest mountain is starting to stink because climbers are using it as a toilet.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Polling stations in Pakistan have closed after an election campaign marred by violence. Authorities cut mobile phone services, citing deteriorating security, but the opposition was unhappy. The election comes almost 2 years since the cricket legend turned Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted in a no-confidence vote. Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Islamabad.
The moment polls opened this morning, all mobile services across the country shut down. Despite assurances communications would not be cut, the government said security was deteriorating, citing yesterday's twin bomb blasts in the Balochistan province. But critics say it was just another attempt to stifle the electoral process.
Shutting off the internet today means that political parties can't share information or even get their supporters out to the polls. And with no clear indication of when mobile services may be restored, it could have an impact on when and how results come out. And finally, none of this alleviates the concerns that these elections may not be free nor fair.
These elections are fair, assures former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. He's had the job 3 times before and is back on the ballot, having just returned to Pakistan from self-imposed exile. Last election, when Imran Khan won, Mr. Sharif was in prison. This time, it is the cricket superstar turned politician that is in prison. Despite his exceptional popularity, he's not on the ballot, disqualified from running. Members of his party continue in his absence, running as independents, barred from using the party symbol, a cricket bat. Significant given 40% of the population is illiterate. Also not on the ballot, but wielding an incredible amount of influence, is Pakistan's military. It is widely believed winning the military support almost guarantees a pathway to victory. Pakistan is mired in an economic, political, and security emergency. Key to the country's success is the government that can rescue it from its current crises.
Samira Hussain in Pakistan. The biggest mass migration in the world is underway in China, as millions of people head home to celebrate the Chinese New Year. Saturday sees the start of the Year of the Dragon, which is thought to be the most auspicious of the signs. But 2024 is forecast to be a year of economic challenges in China, as it struggles to rebound after strict COVID lockdowns, as Laura Bicker reports.
I'm at the main Beijing station, and the Lunar New Year rush has definitely begun. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people waiting to get inside. Just a constant clunk and whir of wheeled suitcases. Where are you going? Are you going to your hometown?
We will get on the 4 p.m. train. We are going home to spend the Spring Festival and visit our mom, who is 90 years old. We are all going to be reunited this year. I was born in the Dragon Year, so this year I bought red clothes and red pants for a prosperous and thriving new year.
Families are bundled up and loaded up for the long journey back to their hometowns. Authorities expect 9 billion trips will be made in China over the Spring Festival period, a much-needed boost to tourism as the economy slows. Experts fear this cash flow will just be a stopgap as China's economic challenges are far deeper, although some travellers were optimistic about the future.
I hope China will do more trade with the rest of the world. China has been doing great, but we need other countries to actively cooperate to boost the economy.
But other New Year wishes need spiritual intervention. Smoke from hundreds of incense sticks curl over Beijing's Lama Temple. Only a small fraction of the population in China are Buddhist, but many young people have been heading to the temple here to pray for a job. Millions of graduates are out of work as the economy stutters. This Dragon Year, they're clinging to the hope that will change.
The economy has been sluggish. You need to have good ideas and back yourself. But praying to the Buddha and burning incense, that will also help.
What are your hopes for the new year as a young person in China? Money, big money, says this young lady of her new year hopes, echoing the thoughts of many.
Happy New Year!
Even the very young have their future in mind. I want to get top marks in my exams every time, says this 10-year-old. I want to get into a good high school, says this girl who's in grade 12. Whatever their dreams for the future, the time now is for food and for family. And after years of pandemic restrictions, that's something people here don't take for granted.
Our Beijing correspondent Laura Bicker. Remarkable new archaeological research suggests that our species might be quite a bit older than previously thought. If so, it could mean that for several millennia, our forebears, those early Homo sapiens, shared the Earth with Neanderthals. Two new research papers with material from a site in central Germany have updated our understanding of our biological inheritance. Professor Chris Stringer is a researcher in human evolution at the Natural History Museum here in London.
We and the Neanderthals had like a parallel evolution over hundreds of thousands of years, us in Africa, them in Europe and Asia. And then about 60,000 years ago, we think Homo sapiens started to emerge and start to head towards Europe. But we thought that our species didn't really get into Europe until about 41,000 years ago, with only a very short overlap with the Neanderthals before they disappeared. But this new work from Rannis, which looks at a site that was, you know, dug nearly 100 years ago, they've gone back to the site and made remarkable discoveries that there were Homo sapiens at this site making an unusual stone tool industry called the Rannisian with laurel-shaped spear points. So no one knew who made those spear points. We didn't know if it was late Neanderthals or early Homo sapiens. But the new work using DNA has shown that it clearly was Homo sapiens there at a date of 45,000 years. There were many forms of humans, and people even use that term differently. But yes, I regard them as different kinds of humans, and there are at least five kinds around in the last 100,000 years, and we're the last ones left. And so what's obviously one of the big questions is, why is that? What happened to the others? But this would suggest that there was a significant period of overlap between the last Neanderthals and the first Homo sapiens in Europe, and they coexisted for a period of time. They did a bit of interbreeding. Maybe they even shared ideas with each other. And what's interesting is these Rannis people were already adapting to very cold conditions, and that's surprising too. We thought it took a while for Homo sapiens to manage to do that.
Professor Chris Stringer. It is best known for use in the bedroom, but Viagra could have another rather important side effect. Researchers from University College London found that men who took such drugs were 18% less likely to develop Alzheimer's. Professor Tara Spires-Jones is president of the British Neuroscience Association and has been looking at the study.
This is a great study, very large and well conducted, with looking at over 250,000 men. There have been previous studies that similarly showed people taking this type of drug called phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors had a reduced risk of dementia. And already some work has been done in animals and in humans showing how this drug might be helping protect the brain. So it does open the door and make it even more important that we keep following this.
I'm fascinated. I'm told that what this is called is a confounding factor in research. In other words, that, you know, there may be something else going on. If you wanted a control study to check whether it's the pill or the sex life, as it were, that's making the difference to the health of people's brains, is there a way of easily isolating that factor?
Easily, no, but certainly there's a way, and the authors of the study propose a great idea, which is to follow this up with an actual randomized control trial where you give people randomly either the drug at different doses or a placebo. And of course, we'd want to test women and men, right, to be sure that this sort of treatment, which helps your vasculature as well as your sex life, can be protective in the brain. So yeah, a randomized control trial would be an excellent way of testing.
I think what's fascinating about this is the idea of looking at existing pharmaceuticals to see whether they can help, alongside, obviously, some very important work to look at completely new drugs.
Absolutely. So in the field, we call that drug repurposing. And sometimes you'll get lucky, and one of the drugs that's already approved for something like, in this case, erectile dysfunction, and also is used to treat some types of hypertension, might also be protecting the brain. But as a field, we look at both ends, right? We look at whether things that already exist and are already approved can help people. And we're also looking at what's happening in the brain at a detailed level so we can develop new, very targeted treatments.
So finally, if new studies are needed, are we months from an answer or probably many years?
Oh, years for this. So a randomized trial is very expensive and takes quite a long time. So yes, it would be years before we know for sure whether this treatment would be a prevention for dementia.
Professor Tara Spires-Jones from the University of Edinburgh talking to the BBC's Nick Robinson. When climbing the world's tallest mountain, it's not just the altitude or Himalayan view that can take your breath away. According to Sherpas, Everest has started to stink because of all the climbers going to the toilet on it. Now, those attempting the mountain or the nearby Mount Lhotse are required by local authorities in Nepal to collect their waste in special poo bags, which will be checked on their return to base camp. The story was broken by our environment correspondent, Navin Singh Khadka. I asked him what Everest climbers had been doing with their waste up until now.
Well, see, when I speak to the operators or the climbers themselves, majority of them, they are using the spaces out there. Very few individuals or very few groups are using biodegradable bags, the poo bags that you mentioned just now. But largely, it's been the open spaces. Now, the thing is, you know, there are some locations like South Col, that's Camp 4, where, you know, it's a very heavily wind-swept location so that no accumulation of snow, that means the barren rocks. And that is where you get to see. And that's why these operators or the authorities are very concerned. And that's why they're making this move.
So it just stays there causing a stink?
Yes. And then also, when I further talk to different operators or even the Sherpas, what they say is, in this current climate change, of course, even if it was buried, because, you know, where the temperature is a bit high, it kind of gets exposed. And also, these are the water resources, not to forget, for downstream people, and they are very worried.
Yeah, not pleasant. So what are climbers supposed to do in future?
So what they're doing is, the local authority, that's the Pasang Lamu Rural Municipality, they are now asking people to buy the poo bags if they don't bring themselves, and then take them up and then bring it back with the excrement, and that will be treated, that will be collected at the base camp. And at the base camp, as we know, it's already like, you know, they do use separate tents as toilets, and barrels are used to collect and then dispose somewhere down below the base camp. That's exactly where it's going to go. Now, the question is, how effectively will they implement this?
Yeah, will they really be inspecting these poo bags as the climbers return?
Now, that is the question, because in the past, one after another, rules announced by the central government didn't work so well. But in this case, because it's the local authority and they are saying that they knew that central government is largely missing on the ground, we will be on the ground, we'll be checking, we'll be doing it.
Our environment correspondent, Navin Singh Hadgar. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean and produced by Sean Wales. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.